The July 25th, 2014 rain report is coming up in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with this rain report. As we all become chronologically challenged, we hear ourselves or others say,
"You know, things aren't like what they used to be."
So what were things in ham radio like back in the 50s and 60s? Ted Craven, W0TCW, a former employee of Collins Radio, expressed his perspective at the 2014 Dayton Hamvention. His thoughts do not necessarily reflect those of anyone affiliated with the Rain Report.
In 1952, when I got into this hobby, hams were inventive, they were creative thinkers and peddlers. They really were. I'm sorry to say I don't think you see much of that anymore. Most of them now buy a piece of Japanese equipment, and if they open the lid on it, they have no idea what's going on inside. Which reminds me of a story, and I'll share this with you right quickly. I had a friend, 1952, when I first met him, that was a broadcast engineer, and he loved 5 meters. 5 meters is just now 6. They changed the frequency, but it was 5 meters. And he'd get on. He was in about around Butler, Missouri, frankly. If you ever heard of where Butler is, that's where Henry Radio was located. So he was around Butler, and we went to a picnic about once a quarter. One day he said, "I used to get on 5 meters and talk to the guys in California." He said, "You could do it with 2 or 3 watts." And he said, "I'd get on there," and he said, several times, hams in Kansas City would get on. And he said, "The guy in California would come back," and he said, "Man," he said, "I don't know what happened to you, but the hams in Kansas City, just, they cuffed you out. They walked all over you." Now, this is AM days. So they had to have been running some power, or it had been squealing. And he said, "I did that about 2 or 3 weeks in a row," and he said, "I got all that I wanted. Got out and broadcast transmitter. Had 833 in the final. That's a kilowatt and a half output tube by itself." So he said, "Got her all rebuilt. Tuned it up to 5 meters. And then he said, "I tuned that thing till the plates was cherry red." Now, I don't know about you, but that's at least, in my opinion, a full gallon on 5 meters. And he said, "I was on talking to California, and they said, 'Man, we don't know what happened to you, but the hams in Kansas City just flat covered you up. You're gone.'" He said, "Oh, wait a minute." He said, "I reached over and turned the plate voltage on." And ham in California come back to him, and he said, "I don't know what you did, but," he said, "there ain't anybody else on 5 meters but you." He said, "I just turned the antenna around." Now, that was back in the days when 1,000 watts output on AM was something else, and on 5 meters, which is up around 60 megs, that was something else. But those are the kind of people you ran into. They were inventive. They did things that were interesting. 1952, interesting year, because homes were just a tiny bit worth $9,000. Yearly income, $3,850. The new car, buy for $1,754 or $59, somewhere along in there. Monthly rent for a home, around $80. Now, why do I mention that? In 1950, the Collins KW1 came out, and it was very, very popular still in 52. And if you could afford one of them, man, you were the epitome of ham radio operator. Well, I did a little checking. The KW1, when it came out in 1950, was $3,850. What did I say the yearly salary was for somebody in 52? $3,850. Now, I don't know how much money you make, but in this day and time, the guys in some of the positions make $35,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. Can you imagine paying that much for a ham rig? That's what they got. That's why there wasn't very many of them made or sold, too, believe me. Now, they had the ultimate station. The 32V3 came out in 1951, and it was $475. Well, you know that you could send a kid to Yale, or Harvard, rather, for a year for $600. So for a tiny bit less than $100 difference, you could have a ham rig or send your kid to school. Which would you do? So 75A3, that was 1952, the latest thing out. That was $530. So the cost of equipment in relationship to what folks' salary was, it was pretty interesting. And that was college. That's why that when you got out and talked to hams in 1952 and say, "What are you using?" "I'm using an Eldeco TR-75. I'm using a homemade rig." "What do you got for a receiver?" "Well, it's a Helicrafters." That's why they had that. Collins had the Cadillac, and that's why they got to be named the Cadillac of the industry, because, man, the average man on the street couldn't afford them. How many of you have a collection of Collins gear? How many of you have more than 2 pieces? How many of you have more than 10 pieces? Okay, I won't go any more than that, because you embarrass the dickens out of me. I think I've got 6. 2 KWM2s, 230L1s, and, you know, that kind of thing. 2 HPM. Let's jump now to 1957. In 1957, the KWM one came out. Back for a second in something that has kind of been a bit of a point for me. I said hams were inventive. And I have been told, oh, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that because that's not Collins quality or Collins factory acceptable. Well, I'd like to say to some folks, they changed from slotted cabinets to round hole cabinets in the 32V3, from V1 to V3, and closed the lid so you couldn't open the lid because the ham said, you know what, we're getting too much TVI out of it. They put a shield inside the 32V3. Why? Because the ham told them, you're getting too much TVI out of it. So when I come along and I do something to a radio, and they say, oh, Collins wouldn't allow that. I'm saying, huh? As a Collins employee, Collins did something that a lot of companies don't do. They had what's called engineering free stock. That meant that if you were a ham and you could possibly do something that would improve or come up with something that for a Collins, it was theirs automatically, yes. But they would support you for it. Not everything made it. Not everything went. But it got there. And so the KWM-1 was a classic. When they tell me, oh, you can't do that because that's not Collins manufacturing. Do you know where the KWM-1 came from? Ham radio operator decided he wanted a transceiver, set in his basement with a 75A4. I could give you his callers, but I don't have him right at the minute. With a 75A4, and he said, I'd like to make the oscillators in those things blow instead of suck. And he did. And he was using it on the air, and the word got back to Mr. Collins. And he said, I want to go see this. So he went over to the man's house. Now, honestly, the guy was an engineer on Collins' staff, but he didn't do that modification purpose for Collins. He did it on his own. Did it for himself. And Mr. Collins says, I like that. Can we build something that way? And that's how the KWM-1 came around.
You're listening to the thoughts of Ted Craven, W0TCW, a former employee of Collins Radio and a current restorer of Collins Radio gear. This is The Rain Report, usually available on Twitter at The Rain Report.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
So when they tell me, oh, that's not Collins quality, they won't know, oh, that's not good enough. Then I say, well, you know what? There was an awful lot of ham radio operators that were engineers and line people and everything else at Collins that contributed a lot to what Collins developed in the amateur radio market. The amateur radio market was really a byproduct of something for hams to use, test out, put the finishing touches on, and then the military got to buy them. So don't tell me. Now, the reason I've got into that little tirade is because I'm going to show you some things that I have put together and some ideas and some thoughts. So when they look at him and say, that's not Collins quality, it wasn't intended to be. It's just things that have worked for me. I'm not suggesting you try them or anything else. This is number 9 in the series, periodic maintenance on your Collins equipment. There's something else that I found among him in the early days. If you had some piece of equipment and you was having trouble with it, not one second did any of them send it back to factory. They said, let me come over and let me look at it with you. And they'd have to get back on the air. And they didn't charge you for it. They have to put up antennas, all kinds of things that does not happen in this day and time. The hobby has gotten out of hand, in my opinion. It is no longer a hobby, it's a business. And when that happens, it's not any fun anymore. I've left this up here. Kind of this is the tools and products, but I wanted to point out control cleaner and contact cleaner. And I want to make this saying right here. The old saying, if a little does good, a lot does better, is some of the worst and poorest advice anybody could ever have. So they will do well to mention that there's significant difference between control cleaner and D5. I use the Oxy D5, believe me, on sliding and contacts and switch things and things like that. I'm not against that respect. Most good quality control cleaners do not contain chemicals that will damage potentiometers. It's been in our experience that the Deoxy D5 contain chemicals that are to react to oxidation, and that's what it's designed for. And as such, may damage the carbon composition in most potentiometers used in Collins equipment. So we recommend that Deoxy not be used on potentiometers in Collins gear.
And that concludes the thoughts and observations of former Collins Radio employee Ted Craven, W0TCW, expressed at the 2014 Dayton Hamvention. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2014 Rain, all rights reserved. Now for everyone connected with the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from The Rain Report, www.therainreport.com.